From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on a September night in 1988, and I want to warn listeners that the subject matter this hour will involve descriptions of abuse and violence. It is not easy to hear for anybody, but in particular, if you're concerned about those kind of subjects, just know that that's the direction we're going. Because in 1988, two young girls were kidnapped. Saya and Sarah were 8 and 6 years old when their mother's boyfriend stole them from their home late at night and took them out to the woods. For hours, the man raped Saya, and then he stabbed both girls, intending to kill them. 6-year-old Sarah died. 8-year-old Saya remarkably survived. And that short paragraph is horrific enough, but there is more to the story, and over the years, Saya Rivasfar has taken this tragedy and used it to alert and help others. Rivasfar spent years with the New York State Police becoming an investigator and joining the board at places like the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and Bavona Child Advocacy Center. Her story, while difficult to hear, has helped countless others understand some of the dangers that children can face. Bavona's Child Abuse Summit for Professionals is returning to an in-person conference for the first time since the pandemic. It's happening over the next couple of days, April 24th and 25th, and there is still room for you or someone that you know who might benefit from this. The summit is designed to support professionals who work with children and on cases of abuse. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Bavona's growth. They've got a second location. There's a lot going on. Let me welcome Dr. Danielle Lyman-Torres, who's the president and CEO of Bavona Child Advocacy Center. Welcome. Thank you for making time for us today.
Thank you for having us.
And Saya Rivasfar, a retired New York State Police investigator and a Bavona CAC board member, retired just recently. Congratulations on your retirement. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you, my honor.
Dr. Danielle Lyman-Torres, let me start with you here. A lot happening for Bavona. Let's talk about this week. And then before we get to Saya's story, I want to talk about kind of the change in the growth happening in Bavona, because you just had a big announcement recently, didn't you?
We sure did. This week we have our Child Abuse Summit, which is the largest gathering for this type of subject in the Northeast. And we are proud to have hosted this summit for a number of years. And this is our first time back in person since 2019. And we're going to have hundreds of people from around the country who work with children, a variety of ways, not just around child abuse, but certainly those who do education, law enforcement, healthcare, social work, counseling, you name it. But really, we want a lot of organizations that work with children, parents, to come out and learn more. It's at the Convention Center. It's tomorrow and Thursday, and we do have room. People can walk in and register. We encourage it. It is a great opportunity to learn more.
You start when? Tomorrow morning?
We start tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.
9 o'clock tomorrow at the Convention Center.
At the Convention Center.
And Bavona's website's got more. We will post in our show notes more if you want links later today, if you want to share them. But this is obviously an important event. And, you know, it sounds like to me you're growing. With a second location, what's going on?
Yeah, we announced that we are going to be opening a second location this fall. It's going to be called Beacon Place. And it's going to be at the Skyview on the Ridge location in Irondequoit. We really needed to do this because we have got to expand our services to include more prevention, including ongoing therapies, counseling for children who are in recovery. We need to stay with them longer is what we've identified. You know, we've been around nearly 20 years providing intervention services to children as they've experienced that trauma of abuse, like at that time of disclosure or at the time of abuse. And we really focus on stabilization during that first intervention. But we also know that we need to stay with children and families longer through their recovery. Recovery is not a 12-month process. It's a lifelong process. And 70% of the children we see at Bavona are under 12. And they have not processed what has happened to them and will not fully process what has happened to them. You know, it's going to take many years. And as they go through adolescence, we want to be there providing more ongoing therapies, counseling, groups, but also parent services, making sure that we're getting high-risk parents, parents who are involved maybe in other systems, domestic violence, mental health, substance use. Those parents also have another status, you know, as parent. And often as they're being served for their primary needs, their status as parent is not necessarily getting what it needs, and their children sometimes suffer from that. And we're trying to prevent those things from happening. So our new location will focus on those services.
As we're going to learn with Saya's story, you know, sadly, when a child has been abused, the abuser sometimes isn't done with them. And there's a lot of work to protect children going forward, even if they can come forward and talk about what has already happened in the past, right?
Absolutely. It's safety, maintaining that safety for children is ongoing. And part of that is, you know, 90% of children who are abused by someone they know and trust, someone close to them that they're going to continue to see throughout their life. And how do we restore that family to safety? How do we restore that child to safety so they can continue to interact with their family in a safe way going forward?
Is it strange that I feel like I wish you weren't expanding?
Yeah. Yeah, we wish
it's a tough commentary on our society.
Yeah,
that this has to happen.
Well,
I wonder in the future if there's a day where you say, you know what, we're going to scale back here. We've done a lot of work here, and we're in a much better place as a society.
We hope. You know, right now, 5 children die every day in this country from abuse and neglect. 5 children every single day in the United States die from abuse or neglect. So we've got a long way to go. And that happens right here in our own community. You know, in 2022, the child fatalities in Monroe County doubled from the year prior. We have got to do something. We can't keep doing what we've done and expect a different result. But it is a crisis. It's a health crisis. Child abuse is a public health crisis. And we need to do something to stave it off and to stop it. And that's what we're trying to do through more prevention efforts as well as intervention.
5 kids a day?
5 children every day.
You know, I mean, we think about trying to contextualize numbers, and I'm not trying to sort of layer on the need for everyone to grieve all the time because there's a lot to grieve. But in a month, if we're losing 150 children in this country to abuse and neglect every month, if there was a single incident where 150 children were killed, it would be the biggest news story of the year.
That's right.
And it would be trauma that we would all be grieving every day for a long time.
Right.
We'd be thinking about those 150 kids. How did this happen? How did we let this happen? How do you prevent it again? But that is what's happening every month.
Every month. Every month.
Relentlessly. And it's going to happen next month. And it's going to happen the month after that.
That's right. And that's why it's so important that every adult see stopping child abuse and eradicating child abuse as their responsibility. Just because it's not happening in your home doesn't mean it's not your responsibility. It absolutely is. Because all the children that will grow up with this trauma, bring that trauma to their lives and everyone's lives around them. And so it is everyone's responsibility to help recovery when children have been harmed and to try to prevent it whenever possible.
You've gotten to know this woman next to you?
I have.
She's pretty amazing, huh?
She is, the epitome of resilience, courage, and commitment to helping others. Just a champion for children.
Saya, I want to start by asking you, and again, warning listeners that we're going to talk about your story, and it is horrific. I don't know how another word for it, I guess. But I want to start by asking you why you choose to tell it publicly.
Well, honestly, it wasn't something I necessarily wanted to do. It's not something that I freely am able to do without emotion. And but I know it needs to be done. And I have that will and strength and the perseverance to speak about it. So I will. And until I can't anymore, I know that there are victims and survivors out there that can't. They either physically can't or, unfortunately, their lives have been taken. And so I will speak for them.
As we talk about this, please know that of the hundreds of interviews we're going to do every year on this program, this is among the ones where I think, I don't know how to do this, and I'm going to ask clumsy questions that are not designed to be, detailed or awful for no reason. What I hope, having read your story, what I hope our listeners are about to gain is an understanding of how terrible the abuse epidemic that can that is visited upon children can be, how to recognize signs. I mean, every story is different, and we understand that, but certainly I know you feel strongly about making sure the most vulnerable children are protected. And then even after an event where a child survives, what happens? And what do we do about that? So I apologize in advance for everything that you've gone through and having to even talk about this. I will start by asking you, you know, your family situation. You have a number of siblings. You want to take us back a little bit and tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So the importance of this is about the dynamic, the family dynamic. And honestly, this happened to me 30 plus years ago. Mm-hmm. The sad part about it is it still happens today. Maybe there's some small details that are different, but that's why I still continue to talk about it, because the awareness is such a huge factor. It's still something that we need to put out there and make people aware. So I come from a broken family, which we all know is something that is of a societal norm. My parents divorced when I was young. I had a brother and sister, a younger brother and sister at the time. And I was the quote unquote older sister. However, I felt like I was also their mother, because being in a broken family, in my situation, my mother gained custody of us kids. We lived in Florida. And the unfortunate part is, and honestly, I've grown and educated myself on the concept of being a single parent. It is not easy. It is stressful. You will have the ups and downs. And the one thing that my mother didn't have raising us was the education and the resources to get help to get through those difficult times. So she leaned on drugs and alcohol. Our childhood was filled with CPS reports, the Child Protective Services. DSS also is something that it's known for. And we had those bruises and marks and the crying from being beaten, from neighbors hearing it, from teachers seeing it. We had these people in our lives, like was explained, the red flags. But you have to say something if you see these things.
So people were seeing that you and your siblings were?
100%.
Who was doing the abusing?
So at the hand of my mother was the physical, mental, emotional abuse, basically because she didn't know how to parent. She didn't have the right skills to parent through her stress of having three young kids. You know, I was 2 years older than my sister Sarah. I was 4 years, I am 4 years older than my younger brother Arash. And so, yeah, it was an absolute crazy fest for her. However, did not excuse how she responded.
Was it worse when she was drinking or on drugs?
Well, yes, she had no control. Mm-hmm. You know, she would grab a twig off of a tree if she didn't have anything to hit us with. She didn't have the belt that she would normally grab or the spoon out of the kitchen to hit us with. I mean, she just lost control.
And I want to be clear that this was not in your teenage years.
No, this was, I was seven and younger.
Seven and younger. So again, Saya, Sarah, and
Arash,
2 years apart. So 7'5", 3", 6'4", 2", 8'6", 4". So those are the ages we're talking about. So when people would notice, do you remember anybody asking you about it? You know, teachers, other people?
Oh, I remember speaking to the social workers. Also teachers asking about the marks on us. During that time, we were afraid. we lost our father in the divorce and got to rarely see him. So here they're asking about these marks, which we knew our mother had done to us. So we were afraid we were going to lose her as well. So what do kids do still to this day? They try to protect the one person that is supposed to love them and care for them. They still protect them. And we lie. We lie. We say, oh, we got into a fight. My sister or my brother did this and that. Or, you know, unfortunately, it's something that these are reasons why we have to educate our kids and our families on how important this is.
Once again, and I'm going to keep saying it throughout the hour, just know if you're tuning in now on Connections, that we are talking about some really tough subjects today, including child abuse and violence. And Saya Rivasvar is telling her family story, her story, and her sibling's story that is very detailed. So just know that, and if that helps you decide whether this is a program you can hear, just there you go. How often did your mom have boyfriends or men in her life?
Well, since the divorce, I felt like there were men in and out of our lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, we jumped from home to home as well.
It wasn't stable.
It was not stable whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we got used to one male in our life, and then there was another, and then there was another. And unfortunately, I think that my mom thought that that was something that she needed in order to, you know, support us and take care of us. And sadly, it was a very selfish reason, and we were left kind of to fend for ourselves.
We're going to move forward to September 1988, but before we even talk about that night, well, at that point, had you known this particular, I guess it was a boyfriend of your mother's?
Yes, it was for approximately a year before.
A year. Okay. Were you scared of him?
It was being scared of him. It was being uncomfortable around him. I even later found out that I even told an adult a few weeks before September 1988 happened that I didn't like him, specifically stated I did not like this person named Ray Wyke.
So it was that pressing to you that at age of 8,
correct,
you were voicing it to other people.
Yes.
Okay. I guess I will just cede the floor to you and let you describe what happened.
So knowing Ray Wyke for this year, prior to September 21st, 1988, I refer to him as a monster. I don't even understand how human beings can violate innocent children as they do. So this monster, we knew for about a year. He was in our lives like normal days, also birthday parties and other functions. No matter what we were doing, the numerous amounts of kids and adults around us, he would find a way to pull me aside, away from everyone, one-on-one, and he would abuse me, sexually abuse me. He said that this was our secret. He said if I was good and kept our secret, that he would continue to bring me gifts, whether it be candy or whatever it may be. And he also said that if I told, that he would hurt my family. And that was the most important piece of this whole conversation that we had, was that he threatened to hurt my family, and therefore there was no way I could tell that secret that we had of him hurting me constantly over this year.
That's how he paralyzed you.
Yes.
Probably, we'll talk about this in our second half hour, probably a common tactic.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
So, moving on, even to a point where my mother identified at one event that we had, a pool party. I got out of that pool. Ray was the only adult in that pool with all of us kids. I got out of that pool, and my mother asked me before going into the house, she said, "Is Ray touching you?" And I immediately was shocked and stopped and couldn't think of anything else besides no, and ran into the house. He was, in fact, molesting me in the pool where I thought no one could see, but clearly there must have been some indication for my mother to be able to ask that question of me. And I know that, unfortunately, I was probably not the only kid that was being touched in that pool. So, yes, many people observed things wrong, whether it be by Ray Wyke or my mother. So it comes to September 21st, 1988. My mother goes out to a bar, has a different boyfriend watch us. This was a typical thing. This was her stress relief, that she would go out and drink and left us home. It was a school night. My sister and I share a room. My brother has his own room. He's 4 at the time. My sister is 6. I'm 8. So a thing that I think of, and I think the brilliant idea, is that for my sister and I to dress in our school clothes that night so that we could avoid getting into trouble by our mother, because we would miss the bus. We would run late. We're trying to get ready. So I said, "Sarah, we're going to wear our school clothes to bed so that way we can just roll out of bed, brush our teeth, and catch that bus so we're not going to get in trouble by mom." And so that night, I threw on my t-shirt and jeans. And I even had a pair of sneakers that were brand new and I was super excited to wear. And of course, this is where I lose people. And then there are those others who are just about my age or older and understand that Punky Brewster was on those pair of sneakers that I wore.
I think you and I are the same age.
So there you go.
Yeah, so, it was a big deal.
It was, and she was my idol at that age. You know, tomboy, you know, liked to just kind of be free and you know, it was just someone I looked up to. And so, yeah, I even wore those sneakers to bed. You know, on the other end, my sister, she was the dressy, girly girl type. So she wore a skirt and a blouse, and that's what we went to bed in. So the next thing we knew was we were being carried out of our beds. And it was nighttime. I opened my eyes. I'm being carried out of we shared a bunk bed. I'm being carried out of the top bunk by Ray. And I confirmed who it was and didn't think anything of it because I knew that I knew him and I knew that that was one of my mother's boyfriends. I asked him where we were headed and he said, "We're going to go see your mom." So it all fit. I knew my mom was out. Where her other boyfriend was, I'm not sure at the time, but Ray took me, carried me outside of the apartment. He took me to the back door and then to the front of the house where he parked his car and then went back into the apartment through the back. Later found out that he crowbarred the back door actually open, and that was the only door. The front door had a deadbolt. The back door did not. So that was the only door he had access to. And so he went to carry my sister to the car as well. He put her in the back seat. I was in the front seat. He hopped into the car and took off about 20 minutes just outside of Escambia County. It was Santa Rosa County that this took place. Ray had clearly thought this through. Where we were going was down a dirt road, nobody around. Dark, surrounded by woods. That's where Ray took me out and asked me if I had shared my secret with anybody. And I confirmed with him that I never shared it with anybody. And I didn't. For that one threat that he had provided, he would hurt my family if I ever did. So that's what kept me from telling anybody what he was doing. After that, he grabbed things in his trunk and went back to my sister. And he tied my sister up. He tied her hands up. He tied her feet up. And that's where we began to cry and have concern that this wasn't exactly going to see our mom. This was not an okay situation. This was a very scary and upsetting situation. We asked him, you know, why he was doing this, and he said, if you're good, you get to see your mother. She's just down the road. So that eased our mind a little bit. And what Ray ended up doing was he ended up raping me. He ended up making me do things to him that no child should ever be forced to do. I screamed and cried in pain until I didn't feel anything anymore. And I just thought that it'll be over soon. And by a miracle, there was a car that came down this dirt road, and so Ray stopped. So after what was hours, he stopped raping me. He told me to go into the car, keep our heads down, while he approached this person in the vehicle that came down the road. Well, Ray went up to this person in the vehicle and told the person that he was having car trouble, but he's all set. The one thing that would have concerned someone who saw Ray in this situation would have been the white pair of shorts that he had changed into that were covered in blood now. So this person in this vehicle, absolutely, what we later found out, was terrified and didn't skip a beat to just take off and get out of there away from this monster covered in blood for who knows what reason. So Ray hops into the car, starts driving down until he doesn't see the other car in his sight. Once he stops the car, he opens up his driver's side door and starts to rape me in front of my sister. My sister starts crying and asking me why he's doing this and what he's doing. And all I could tell her was that it was going to be okay and that it's almost over. Day broke, and that's when Ray stopped. He told me to put my clothes back on, to walk outside the car. He picked up my sister and told me to walk towards the woods. He put my sister down by the tree. He had me standing in front of him, and he told me to say my prayers. As he took out a knife, he began to cut my throat. I didn't feel anything at the time. All I could do was touch my throat. I looked at the blood, and I dropped down to the ground. I closed my eyes, and I knew the only thing I could do was play dead. Play dead so that Ray wouldn't think I was still alive and kill me indefinitely. The worst part about this was that Sarah just saw this happen. So she was screaming and crying. I could feel her kicking the ground until she didn't. She stopped. I didn't hear her anymore. I felt Ray jump over my body and run to his car and take off. That's when I knew I could stand up and go over and check up on Sarah. I looked at her, and I saw her eyes, and I saw all the blood, and I called her name out over and over again, and I knew she wasn't going to answer. So I had to go get help, and that's what I did. I put one hand on my neck and I walked out of those woods and onto this dirt road and down this dirt road until I saw a blue truck, a blue pickup truck at the end of this dirt road. And so my other hand, I waved it down to make sure they didn't leave and walked up to this couple in this truck. And all I could tell them was that Ray killed my sister. They immediately got some cloth for my neck and they asked me if I was sure about Ray killing my sister. And I said, yes. And they rushed me to a nearby store to call 911.
He had missed the main artery in your neck?
He did. The tip of the knife rested at my jugular.
Can you sum up some of the events going forward? Because, you know, you lost your sister, and who knows where people might wonder where Ray was going and what happened. And this is important because Ray had already tried to kill you and would try to continue to victimize you.
Absolutely. He was already a convicted felon. There was no question that he was a monster and he hurt other kids prior to Sarah and I and just didn't get caught or punished enough to prevent it from happening. So this monster takes off. They find him back at his parents' house asleep. He has his car in the driveway with bloody handprints, finger marks all over his car, inside his car. He has his white shorts over a clothes hanger, you know, dripping from trying to rinse out the blood. And he goes to sleep. And so hours later, after I'm rushed to the hospital and in surgery, they surround the house. They finally, after trying to advise him that this is not a joke and that, you know, he wakes up and understands that there are police outside, he just didn't get the fact that he thought he was going to get away with killing two little girls. And didn't realize that he was caught, that I survived until trial started and he found out that he's, of course, going to be punished for what he has done. He is going to be held accountable. And so I went through all of the trials after I got out of the hospital. I went and I talked to all of these people that wanted to know what happened, all the details, you know, from law enforcement to the district attorney's office. And I told that story over and over and over and over again. And of course, the only thing I thought about was my sister and how I have to do this for her. And I have to make sure that no other child has to go through this. So that fight of me just continually having to tell my story and continually, you know, feeling that fear of Ray is going to hurt me again, I just had to push it away. I had to focus on getting this monster put away for life.
Florida has the death penalty.
They do.
He goes to prison, but can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, he was obviously convicted, sentenced to death row. He pled not guilty through the whole thing. Hundreds of pieces of evidence, eyewitness. He goes to prison. This is over a decade. I get a handwritten 15-page letter from him from death row, from prison, which he sent ultimately to his family in Pennsylvania, and that family in Pennsylvania sent it to my home in Rochester here. So luckily, here I am in high school at the time.
Here in Rochester?
Here in Rochester, yep. And I don't get the mail. My parents get the mail. They read this. They notify the DA's office. He gets punished and his mailing privileges taken away. However, this letter was nothing but threats, trying to make me recant and tell me that I'm lying and all of these horrible things, describing how I couldn't handle what he has and just horrible things. Horrible re-victimization over and over again. So he has appeals. They deny those appeals. I'm just waiting. And I go to those appeals too, because I want him to understand that I'm not giving up, that he will pay for what he has done to Sarah and I, and he will no longer be able to do that to anybody else. And we find out that he actually dies in prison. So July 2004, we get a phone call from a family member who sees a memorial for him online for death row inmates. That's how we found out, actually.
How did you feel?
It was a bittersweet feeling. I was so thrilled that, oh my God, I don't have to worry about him.
Relief?
Relief, yeah. For sure, relief.
Yeah.
I don't have to feel like he's going to re-victimize me again, or he's going to, you know, hurt someone else. It was a relief for my family and I, but also a disappointment that he was able to do all these things, live all those extra years. And you know, I'm not a religious person. However, I believe there was a higher power. And being that the justice system can, for lack of better words, be a struggle to deal with, there was an intervention, and he was taken care of one way or another. He died of lung cancer. And so, you know, our family was able to close up this chapter of our lives.
Only if it's pertinent can I ask you how things ended up in terms of your relationship with your mother.
Absolutely. A lot of people ask about that.
Again, I want you to tell the story that you feel is important for listeners, as hard as it is. We're talking to Saya Rivasvar, who's now a retired state police investigator who did amazing work in her career in law enforcement and now is on the board of the Bavona Child Advocacy Center, which has a lot going on this week, including an annual summit in the next couple of days. They have a second location they're opening. There's a lot happening. And Saya is willing to tell this story so the community knows what kids can go through. And as we heard, 5 kids a day are dying of abuse and neglect in this country every day. So I only ask because, you know, your mom had abused you.
Mm-hmm.
And then she lost her daughter, nearly lost you.
Right.
Take us through a little bit of that.
So at that time, the judicial system felt like, okay, this mother is not fit to care for these kids. You know, sadly, we lost Sarah in order for them to realize that. So my father was able to regain custody of my brother and I. And we left Florida and went to New York, where he was currently living. And so, you know, my brother and I were terrified. My mother got visitation rights. And we were terrified to go back to Florida, where this all happened, where we know that she's not stable enough to even care for us, even for a short period of time. You know, she needed help, and she never got it. And honestly, I don't think she ever will, because even to this day, you know, I feel bad for her. I do. Some people have hate for her, and I did for so many years. I had questions. I felt that she was responsible, you know, not nearly as much as Ray Wyke, but I felt that she had hand in, she could have helped us. She could have saved us from this. She could have, you know, done something that, you know, would provide my sister's life still be mm-hmm. a thing. And, you know, so we finally stopped going and visiting her. We told our father, we can't do it anymore. We're afraid. We're not comfortable. There's still abuse, you know, at her hand. And enough's enough. So we stopped going, went through a huge custody battle, which I know Rochester was a huge support in that, along with so many other officials. And it was just an amazing support system that we had here. And honestly, that's how I got through this. Feeling safe, being away from that environment, getting all sorts of counseling and therapies. My mother never got that. She just doesn't understand how much that can help someone. And it's not a sign of weakness. Mm-hmm. It's in fact a sign of strength to be able to understand that you need help and where you can get that help and how you need to continuously have that help in order to stay fighting. I mean, not just survive, but fight back. And for that life that you've been giving, I was blessed with this life. There was a reason why I survived. And I believe my mission as I speak to you now is to spread that message of awareness.
So let me ask both of our guests then, through the lessons of this story, we're not telling this story, we're not bringing Asaya on the program today just for salacious reasons. This is not a story that I think anyone wishes were true or would want to even sit through. And we're talking Newtown next hour. These are very heavy things today, but they are important for our society to understand. So, what are the most important lessons you want listeners to understand from your story? Your mom didn't get the help that you said she needed. And there's a lot of kids being raised by parents or guardians who maybe don't have those skills and don't have that help and maybe don't believe in it or don't know how to get it. What do you want for them?
Honestly, that's why I have such a passion about Bavona Child Advocacy Center. This is a resource that if I had even parts of it as a child in my family, were provided this intervention and the prevention, the education that comes with it, how much our lives would be so enriched and empowered. But I had to find that myself. Our family had to do that on our own. So that's honestly so important to understand where your resources are. And the Bavona Child Advocacy Center is the mothership of resources for children and their families. When you're going through these horrible, horrific situations in your life, and if you want to prevent these things from happening in your life, you know, that's what we truly want. You know, obviously, we have a long way to go before, you know, we can say we're out of a job regarding child advocacy. And I you know, we all in this room wish that and hope for that. And that's why we work so hard and are so passionate about this. But in the meantime, we'll spread the message. Watch for those red flags. And you can't be afraid to even just say something. So it may not be child abuse or sex abuse or whatever, but you just don't know when it's going to save that child's life, our future. If we can't step up for them because they can't do it themselves, then what do we have?
What do you think, Dr. Lyman-Torres?
Well, I think, you know, Saya's story and many, many other children's story, really, it starts with their parents, right? The children are innocent and rely on their parents. And not all parents are in a place where they can be their best. You know, many parents have their own trauma. The residual trauma, intergenerational trauma is profound. And parents who have not dealt with their own trauma have a very hard time keeping their children safe from that same trauma and or even spotting or dealing with the red flags that they see around them. And we see that time and time again. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to interrupt some of that. Parents who might be in other again, systems, whether they're getting services for domestic violence or substance use disorder. I mean, 2/3 of the people receiving substance abuse treatment right now report being abused as children. 2/3. So the trauma just keeps, you know, compounding itself. What we have to do is we have to interrupt that. We have to get involved with parents who are already being served by other systems, by domestic violence, substance use, mental health, and make sure that as parents are being served in those areas, that they are also seen as parents and they get skills to deal with that. But not only skills, but that there's case management. Because we see case after case where parents who are in these systems that we know they have one of these co-occurring disorders, we're not dealing with the fact that they have children. They're not getting case management. And we see time and time again, not only are children abused, but they die. And we can do something about that. We can help families grow together in recovery together with the right supports and services, because it is best for children to be with their families. Even if their families are full of trauma, we can help, because it still is ultimately best for the children to be with their family if they can be safe. And we can help that, and we can interrupt that if we just create a resource, work together, and everybody, as Saya said, speak up, because it is your responsibility. We've had many cases here where people have seen parents walking around with, you know, emaciated infants or infants that look like something's just not right. And then we talk about those cases after they're in the news where the child's been found dead. And what I would really like us to do is to make it our business to say, I'm going to report that even if I don't know what it is, because I know that somebody will follow up on that child and someone will see if they're okay. And then if they are, that someone will help that parent too. Really important.
I mean, the Ray Wikes kind of rule by fear, right? Ray got Saya thinking, when you were getting out of the pool that day and your mom knew something, she was seeing something that was troubling and even asked you, but your brain went right back to what his warning was.
Absolutely.
I can't say yes. I have to say no. They rule by fear. So if they can paralyze kids, then the adults who are starting to notice have to do something. And maybe Bavona makes that easier.
We do. Parents often struggle with this. Some parents have inklings like Zaya's mom did and just don't know what to do with that information. We can help with that. Our staff actually sit down and talk to the children and give them the safety they need to say that secret. You don't have to keep that. Your family's going to be safe. Tell us what's happening to you. And they do. The children, when we give them their voice, they speak. Just like Saya told you, she told someone she didn't like him. We have to listen to children when they say they don't like an adult and ask more questions.
Briefly here, let me grab Frank on the phone, who's been waiting. Hi, Frank. Go ahead.
Hello. First, let me acknowledge your suffering and pain and loss. I'd like to speak to your mother. It sounds strange, but when I was around people who were mistreated, as I was mistreated, I found myself almost envious of them. You know, I call it fascist envy. If only some big boss would come in and restore order, everything would be fine. I think that's the draw many people, many women have when they get involved with dangerous men. All I want to say is that instead of tackling the problem at the bottom, you know, the abused children, perhaps we need to tackle the problem at the top of the violence chain of command. I find myself doing the acts my father did, and I swore I would never do. Psychopaths, true psychopaths aside, I believe everyone is worthy of redemption. And I celebrate your courage and your honesty, and I'm grateful for your story today.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
Yeah, much love to you, Frank. Thank you. And again, I'm sorry what you have gone through, Frank. We got about 90 seconds, and you want to respond to some of what you heard from Frank there, Saya?
No, I appreciate that. Honestly, it's a difficult path. My mother, our relationship is at a distance. I set boundaries. I forgave myself from needing answers from her, from holding her responsible, because I truly am the blessed one. I have the support and the help. And you know, we're gonna fight this. There's no giving up on our future.
Mm. Thank you, Frank. Dr. Lamontores, as we get ready to wrap here, I just want to remind people again, there is a second Pavona location. It's going in Skyview on the Ridge.
That's right.
The old Irondequoit Mall location. That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to geographically locate it. So that's happening.
That's happening.
And your summit is happening over the next couple of days. Starts
yes.
tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. at the
convention
at the convention center in Rochester. You can show up and register there. Who is this summit for over the next couple of days?
Anyone who works with children, champions children, has children, who care or who cares about our future. Come on down.
Those are over the next couple of days. It's a very important event. It's an annual conference, and this is happening for the first time in person since 2019. And we all said this hour, we wish this work wasn't necessary. I wish Sai Rivasfar's story wasn't what it is, but I will also say, oh my goodness, what a powerhouse you are.
Thank you.
How fortunate that your whole family has. I mean, I know you probably think about Sarah all the time. And I'm just so sorry, but I'm so moved by you. Thank you for what you've done for our community. Thank
My
you
pleasure.
Very much.
Thank you.
Sai Rivasfar is a deservedly recently retired New York State Police investigator, but doing work as a board member for Bavona. Dr. Daniel Lamontores, the president and CEO of Bavona Child Advocacy Center. How do people get in touch with Bavona if they need to find you?
Go to our website, www.bavonacac.org.
Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
More connections coming up.